This is an ABC podcast.
Artemis 2 has flown round the moon, and the four astronauts on board are on their way home.
Today, for all humanity, you're pushing beyond that frontier.
We're following every step of the mission in a special daily season of science fiction called Artemis Explained. Stay with us as the mission continues to unfold, with updates from me, Belinda Smith, so you know what just happened and why it matters.
Integrity, over to you.
Search for science fiction on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
It appeared the market was betting on another Taco Tuesday from Donald Trump, and it could be said he's delivered. The US president announcing a two-week ceasefire with Iran, which involves an opening up of the crucial Strait of Hormuz, raising hopes of a more normal flow of energy around the world. But no matter what the final outcome of this conflict, we've seen a dramatic shift in Australia's car market, with electric vehicle sales soaring. Will it prove to be a permanent inflection point? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm ABC business reporter Steph Chalmers.
We're speaking here around 11:30 a.m. Sydney time. I was in early this morning preparing for this latest deadline from Donald Trump, threatening the obliteration effectively of Iran as a civilization, extraordinarily inflammatory language heading into this deadline. And yet the market reaction in Wall Street seemed to be that people weren't taking it overly seriously. There seemed to be some sort of movement once we heard that Pakistan was pushing for this two-week ceasefire agreement, at least something temporary to stop this obliteration, Trump raining hell down on Iran. What do you make of the way that this played out? And is it once again evidence that in the end, on this big stuff, Donald Trump always chickens out?
I think so. I mean, it is somewhat, apart from the human cost of war, it is just a relief to be sitting here talking about, you know, another Taco Tuesday rather than what's, you know, what strikes are currently happening, although it sounds like things are still ongoing. It really did seem like markets were, yeah, betting on there being some sort of deal brokered at the 11th hour, and they were proven correct. We had US futures rising even ahead of Trump's Truth Social post. It was a bit of a scramble. We knew the deadline was 10 a.m., so we would have been one of the first stock markets to react. So around after 8:30, we started to hear that, you know, Trump had announced this two-week pause, going to Truth Social, trying to bring that post up, assuming that that's where he'd made the announcement. And indeed it was. So it was a bit of deja vu of how Donald Trump likes to play politics. But yeah, definitely seems like markets weren't bracing for the opposite.
Yeah, and the other thing that was so interesting here in Australia was yesterday, the Tuesday trading session here in Australia, it was Taco Tuesday in the United States, it's Wednesday here, was that the Australian market rallied yesterday, even though at that point you had the inflammatory language had already begun. It got even worse as we got closer to the deadline. But it did seem that investors here were totally betting that this wasn't a real possibility. I mean, what Donald Trump was threatening, what many people were suggesting were potential war crimes, hitting civilian infrastructure. Obviously, it raised the question of whether or not we would see Iran strike its neighbors' civilian infrastructure, a major escalation. And yet Australia rallied ahead. And then we saw the American trading session, the Wall Street effectively finished flat, despite that deadline looming. Is it just that people have had this play over so many times now that they don't think Donald Trump will do anything that would cause that much chaos?
I think it's got to be that because, you know, these moves, even the rally today, as we're talking, the Australian market was up about 2.5%. That's not kind of, you know, it's not an earth-shattering rally of like, oh, Armageddon's been avoided, which if you were to believe the rhetoric that was, you know, being thrown out there.
Yeah.
So I think it is a case of, you know, we're kind of a year on from that first tariff announcement, and we spent a year really getting played by Donald Trump, moving at the mercy of his announcements, his delays. You know, it's really hard to even keep up with where we are at these extended schedules. So I do think there is just a sense that people do expect this now.
Yeah. And there are still major questions to be answered about actually what does this look like. Donald Trump said in the original announcement, announcing this two-week ceasefire, that it was on the condition of an opening up of the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has backed that to an extent and said that they will be looking to open up the Strait of Hormuz, but ships will be passing through with their permission effectively. And there still remains a real question in the aftermath of this war, if we are getting to the point where there is a more permanent agreement, about whether or not Iran will try to implement some sort of tariff regime where they're taking tolls from ships that pass through. Donald Trump has also suggested that America could somehow be involved in the tolling of ships. I think people need to be careful about thinking this is the end. This is the permanent finish of this conflict and that things will go back to what they were before, because even for individual shipping companies right now, it's a major risk assessment to decide, are you going to be sending your crew, your assets through that strait when at any point this could flare up if either side decides that the other isn't upholding their side of the ceasefire or whatever it might be? And so do you really think we're going to see a full normalization, flow of energy, flow of fertilizer like we saw before this conflict began?
I don't think so. And if you even just look at the text of what Donald Trump's put out on social media and then what's being reported in Iran's state media, they seem to be two very different takes on what's been agreed to. So it doesn't really set it up as...
And once again, there have been major disputes throughout this conflict when Donald Trump says, we're talking, they're open to a deal, and Iran has often contradicted that directly. Now, there does seem to be some sort of agreement in place right now, but they do seem to be, pretty strong differences of opinion about exactly what's being agreed to and what the starting basis is for the negotiations.
Exactly. And it's only this two-week pause. So you're heading into a very short period of time with, you know, seemingly starting from very different bases. So I don't think, as you say, you're going to have companies confident to proceed in, you know, re-entering this trade. But then you've also got the fact that oil-producing countries, their storage was filling up because they couldn't, you know, get their shipments flowing as normal. So then they've stopped producing. So even if we do get ships moving through, that's not going to be a normalization in oil production coming. We've got, you know, a backup of oil in storage, then you've got to get production online. And then I was just having a look at, you know, the damage to oil facilities in Iran and elsewhere in the Middle East.
You know, and the other Gulf states, and whether or not we actually have full appreciation or full transparency about exactly how bad the damage was, because obviously countries also have an incentive to try to keep that stuff private because they don't want to, A, illustrate that the attacks have been effective, but also they're doing their own assessments about, well, how quickly can we actually get this repaired and up to normal production?
Exactly. So we haven't seen that flow through because pretty much what we've been dealing with is just, you know, no flow through the strait. So now say it does actually reopen, there's this backlog, then we're going to have to assess the damage to facilities. So what oil analysts have been saying this morning is that it's not really going to normalize for potentially months, and then we could be looking at a world where, you know, instead of going back to around $60 a barrel or some sort of normal level, it's more like $80 a barrel, because Iran hasn't closed the Strait of Hormuz before. So we now see that that is a possibility, and they've kind of successfully used it as a trigger for Donald Trump to come to the negotiating table. So yeah, I don't think it's going to be something that's going to normalize. I think it'll take months, and then, you know, we're in a new world, essentially.
Yeah, and individual countries have recognized their own vulnerability regarding the flow of energy around the world. We can see it playing out domestically here in Australia. There's a debate around how much we have in reserve, the contracts that we sign. Should Australia have more refining capability here? And those same debates are happening around the world and about how can they make sure that if something like this were to happen in the future, that they aren't as vulnerable. One of the promises of open trade was that you keep prices low. It allows things, you're able to buy from the lowest cost producer of these commodities. But there now has to be a premium, doesn't there, for doing it at home or doing it with other countries that are less vulnerable. And so that's probably going to mean that the base price is just higher than it would otherwise be.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be a situation where there's enough stability that things normalize and the threats to, you know, the flow-on effects through supply chains are going to normalize within a matter of months, I think. And that is assuming that this crisis ends within this 2 weeks. The US Energy Information Administration put out some forecasts last night based on this all wrapping up by the end of April, which you'd have to say is really the best case scenario sitting here, you know, in early April, and that was still looking at elevated prices for several months ahead. So that's, you know, the US government's own modelling. So people are not going to be going to the petrol pump next week and feeling relief, unfortunately.
I want to talk to one of the potential, some would say positive impacts of this conflict, which was the latest data we've got about vehicle sales here in Australia. So for a long time, the uptake of electric vehicles in Australia, I think, has been slower than some people would have liked or thought. Australians are usually quite quick in the uptake of new technology. I'm thinking about smartphones and other consumer devices. It's renowned for being quite quick, but electric vehicles, we seem to lag. That might be partly because of geography, big distances. But it does appear that this might have been a major inflection point, and we've seen the sale of electric vehicles soar, really, since this conflict kicked off, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, this trend was sort of starting to emerge late last year. And as you say, we really were lagging, and it was kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy because we didn't have policies that were really supporting the uptake of electric vehicles to the same extent as overseas. So we were kind of getting lugged with the more expensive or, you know, not that great models, and we were getting the petrol cars that companies couldn't really sell into things like the European market.
Yeah, because Europe had been very proactive in forcing up both fuel standards, that making cars much more efficient, greener if they were internal combustion engines, but also major incentives for people to actually buy electric vehicles. Australia wasn't as aggressive in going after that, were they?
Yeah, so it meant that, you know, we didn't have the same range of models of electric vehicles available for purchase until kind of last year. And then, you know, across the price range, we didn't have the lower end price range, so it wasn't as accessible to people. That sort of was turning around before this, so it was kind of primed for this to happen. And then obviously with fuel costs soaring, it's now at the forefront of people's minds, and that's really been reflected in the stats. So some of our colleagues put together the stats from the Federal Automotive Industry Association. That doesn't include Tesla and Polestar, so they've amalgamated that with the EV Council stats. And that's shown a 42% increase in March of sales.
Wow.
Up to nearly 16,000 battery electric vehicles sold in March. So that's extremely significant, and that's despite overall new car sales dropping. And so you've also seen the share of battery electric vehicle sales increase significantly. So it's more than doubled year on year in March. So not only, you know, the raw sales numbers are going up, but, you know, it's now a much greater share of the new cars Australians are buying.
And when we talk about certain types of technological uptake, they talk about the network effect, which is that it almost becomes exponential, because you need, the more people are using that network, the easier it is and the more incentive other people have to join that network. And so when it comes to electric vehicles, the difficulty has, of course, been charging infrastructure and people feeling confident that if they have an electric vehicle, they have enough charging stations available to them that they aren't anxious about not being able to charge their vehicle if they're going somewhere. And we have seen, even if some people say we're still going too slow, we have seen a surge in charging infrastructure. Over the Easter long weekend, I went down and saw my family in the small town of Joogeong, between Sydney and Melbourne. And there's a tiny little two-port charger in that town. And it was, in the entire time I was there, it always had two electric vehicles attached to it. And you could see it on the roads as you were driving around, a huge increase in, for me anyway, coming back from a few years away, but like you could see how the proliferation of electric vehicles on the roads, and maybe they were the people a little bit more confident going out on the weekend.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the prices of electricity hasn't soared in the way that petrol has, but it does seem to have been an inflection point, a game changer, doesn't it?
Yeah, I've definitely experienced that, you know, driving around Sydney, you know, very aware that I'm living and working in inner Sydney, so it's obviously, you know, a particular sort of bubble, but towards the end of last year, I definitely noticed more electric vehicles, and then heading down the coast to Neala Dulla, where my parents live, I just saw, I never really noticed it before on the roads. And then I do have to say, perhaps it's a bit of confirmation bias because we've actually put an order in, my partner and I, for an electric vehicle on a novated lease. I have to say we did do it in January, so, you know,
you were ahead of the game. Yeah, well done.
But we have not received that yet, and we actually, we went into the showroom about 2 weeks ago now, and, it was a really interesting look at, you know, just the absolute deluge of demand they're experiencing. The salesperson essentially ran away from us, and then the manager came out and he was just
a salesperson running away from a customer.
I know. You know, these things are selling themselves, I think, at this point. And he, the manager, was just saying, you know, we can't even sell you, you know, these demo models. They're sold. We literally can't get them on the floor fast enough. They're already gone. The shipments are being delayed. So this is a Chinese-made EV, so they're kind of beholden to what's happening with shipping as well.
And also, I assume, domestic demand in China, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So one of the advantages Australia has had, well, again, depends on where you sit on the politics of this, but because we no longer have really a domestic car manufacturing market, Australia is much more open to overseas brands than other places that are trying to protect their domestic manufacturing market. So we do have now EVs from around the world, and China is definitely the leading force now, particularly, as you said, kind of the lower price points. But they are also seeing surging demand in China because of this international fuel crisis, energy crisis. And you're seeing that around the world, I'm sure. So Australia is competing to try and get those vehicles here with other places that are also trying to get them at the same time.
You've got BYD as the third best-selling car company overall in Australia.
So, what a transformation. A car company that many people wouldn't have heard of 5 years ago.
Exactly. And they only sell hybrids and electric vehicles. So, you know, it's really evident that the demand's there. But I think just on that issue of the shipping and the vehicles getting to Australia, the car sales manager was saying to us, you know, oh, the cost of shipping is increasing. Mm. So that kind of raised questions for me. You know, we do have more affordable models, but if we do, as you say, we don't manufacture here. So if we're relying on these coming into the country, and we've now got, you know, best case scenario months ahead of shipping disruptions and higher fuel costs, you know, what does that mean for the price for people who haven't kind of been early adopters? And does it become just another area where if you're already wealthy, you already have the cash behind you to get an EV, then you're even more immune from fuel costs?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there is that equity question, but also the flow-on effects of this conflict lasting much longer than perhaps than the conflict itself, that we're going to still see elevated prices for things like transportation for a long time, and that leads through to higher inflation for things like vehicle sales or anything else that's shipped around the world. And so I think that's going to be the real difficult thing for the Reserve Bank and for the government to try to assess about how long does this inflation last, this elevated inflation last, and how do you try to offset that, or how do you try to deal with that in the economy, and how does that shape the budget coming up?
Yeah, well, we've seen, even with, you know, as you were talking about the cost of charging, we haven't really seen electricity prices spike, but we know that, you know, Australia has plenty of solar, but largely so far the benefit of that has flowed to people who own their own homes, you know, don't live in apartments, aren't renting. They have been able to, you know, take up these subsidies to get panels, then more recently battery subsidies. So we do see the government having this proposal. I think it's coming into effect in a couple of months' time for customers in Queensland, New South Wales and South Australia. The default market offer for electricity will involve a few hours of free power during the middle of the day. And the idea of that is to kind of share the benefit of Australia's, you know, rooftop solar boom among people who aren't in a position to have the panels themselves. So, you know, in that way, you could see perhaps you have an EV, you can time it to charge at a particular time, but still, you know, the people who've had the capital behind them to, you know, take up all these subsidies for solar and batteries and now EVs. Yeah, as you say, what does this do for the Reserve Bank trying to, you know, control demand through interest rates, if you've got a growing portion of the population that, you know, owns their home outright or has a smaller mortgage and then perhaps can access all these other things that further insulate them from price rises.
And I think that there is another tricky policy question for the government, particularly when it comes to EVs, which is up until now, they have been trying to incentivize people to buy EVs because both to meet our climate change goals, but also to make us less reliant on overseas refined fuel. And now we have seen this, you know, considerable increase in the number of EVs being sold, bigger share of the market. But at what point do you start to be concerned that actually you're going to see less tax revenue when it comes to the fuel excise? We've just seen the fuel excise be halved for this period, but people who are driving EV vehicles on the roads, they're not paying a fuel excise. That means that revenue will go down over time. And that debate about do you start having a road use charge as a way of getting them to help pay to upkeep the infrastructure, or do you risk putting that in too quickly that you actually turn people off from buying EVs? And obviously the EV industry is saying now is not the time to be talking about new taxes on EVs. What you want is for people to be confidently purchasing these vehicles and help that transition, and we'll deal with it later. The counter view is if you don't implement it soon, then people are going to be too shocked when it actually is put into place, and it's going to be quite dislocating. So you want to kind of get people used to the idea that the way that they're contributing to the upkeep of roads is through maybe a lower road tax that you can ramp up over time as we start to see fuel excise fall off even more. But do you think you do risk upsetting the market before it's fully established by getting in now?
I wonder if now wouldn't be the time to do it while you're still offering these pretty generous incentives in terms of tax concessions through novated leases. Because there was talk about perhaps some of those being wound back early this year. So that was actually why we decided to look at it in early Jan, because there was a review underway and I thought it was going to get taken away, but it hasn't. So while you're still, you know, giving with one hand, perhaps it is the time to, you know, reintroduce that idea, because I saw it being talked about yesterday, but to be honest, it hadn't actually crossed my mind as, you know, an aspiring EV owner. So I would have been pretty shocked if it, you know, I got whacked with a new tax in a few years' time, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And it's always a very tricky thing for governments, obviously, to start putting in place new taxes, but this potentially is going to be a reforming budget, so we'll see whether or not the government is willing to go there. And it's definitely not a debate that's going away anytime soon. Steph, thank you so much for joining us on ABC Business Daily.
Thank you.
And that is it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can reach us with questions or comments. Email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. Catch you next time, Steph.
Bye.